and welcome to the Hoop Collective podcast presented by Xfinity. We talk about the NBA, which we're doing after midnight on Friday morning. Joining us from the TD Garden in Boston, Massachusetts, and apparently sitting in the Bruins press room because he's in front of a Stanley Cup playoffs background, Tim Bontemps.
Sitting in the visiting team press room in Boston because the Bruins and Celtics have been going back-to-back nights, and Donovan Mitchell and Evan Mobley and Caris LeVert were up here a little while ago after Cavs showed up in the second half and our boy Christian and Scooby showed up at halftime and the Celtics did not show up for much of the game.
Excellent. Shout out to Christian and Scooby. Scooby, more popular than Christian, although Christian's our favorite.
Christian's our guy.
Yeah. And very happy to have our old friend and author of the brand new book, Hoop Atlas. Author of the brand new book, Hoop Atlas, Mapping the Remarkable Transformation of the Modern NBA, the one, the only, from Austin, Texas. We have to have a Texan on every podcast.
Every pod.
Kirk Goldsberry.
Happy to fill the quota. Happy to be back. Thank you, guys. Some great games, some parallels between the games we saw tonight. Some road wins, some great shooting from star players, and good to see you guys.
Yeah, we got
use parallels. The map guy, Mealy coming with parallels.
He's boom, good
right off the top.
We got some series, but do you? I am in Indianapolis with the Knicks Pacers series, so I don't have your book with me, but I have a copy of your book. If you could hold it up, it's more of a it's a graphic. How are you describing it in your various media rounds, Kirk? Because
we'll
it's
go
like
by the name of the book, Brian.
Well, yeah, that might help.
It's a Hoop Atlas. I know it's a beautiful it's a beautiful product, and I was showing it to some stuff in it to my son because it goes back over the last 30 years of the NBA and examines the major changes that have transformed the game into a better place. If you ask me, although you know I've been in New York the last 4 days and everybody's been living in the 90s, but yeah, it's a beautiful product, Kirk. I know you put a lot of work into it.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, the illustrator Aaron Dana and I, who worked on Sprawl Ball, are back at it. So there's like 100 and some images in there.
Wow.
And 70,000 words. So you're getting your money's worth of book. But it is like I do, starting in my Grantland days, really love the combination of illustration, scientific graphics, charts, and then of course writing to help tell these stories. But yeah, it's about how the NBA has changed since Jordan. My first chapter here is all about Michael and how he sort of opened up the game later in his career, becoming the best jump shooter in the NBA. And going through Stephen Curry and Nikola Jokic with stops for Manu Ginobili and Bruce Bowen and Kobe Bryant, of course, LeBron James, and just talking about how these guys changed and sort of invented or reinvented the NBA as we know it now. And it was really fun. I'm happy with it, and I'm sure people will love it. So thanks for supporting it, Brian. Hoop Atlas, wherever.
Do you notice one of those names is not like the others? We're talking about Manu Ginobili, talking about Michael Jordan, talking about Stephen Curry, just slides in a Bruce Bowen. Just mention him in there with the rest of those guys. I enjoyed the Spurs reference.
Spurs heritage. Kirk used to be in the Spurs. Used to be in the Spurs front office. I paused in a second there when you said that Michael Jordan was the best jump shooter in the NBA. I mean, I'm not doubting you, but that, I've never heard that. Never heard that. I'm sure you have the data to back it up, but that stops me.
We've got the numbers, and it started when I was at ESPN, and we looked at this for The Last Dance, and they had me go do a dive on Michael, which was probably my favorite project of that time. But yeah, we got the receipts, dude, of course. And that was actually one of the coolest things when doing the research for this project, is giving Michael Jordan the shot chart treatment was something I always wanted to do. Yeah. And we did it around The Last Dance. And when I saw the numbers and made those charts for the first time, Brian, I was like, oh my God, this guy was more like Nowitzki than I realized. Like when you compare his numbers to everybody else, in 1996, his fifth title is the first time the NBA really had this data. And Michael was obviously the leading mid-range scorer in the NBA, but he was also like second or third most efficient among the top 100 of them. He was really good at basketball. And among those things he was really good at was shooting. And I don't think he got his fair due for that. So it's kind of cool to revisit him in the way we look at players now and find that he not only does he pass the smell test, he passes it with flying colors. And like I said, he's more like Dirk than I ever realized. And he wouldn't have won those last three championships if he didn't become such an unstoppable jump shooter.
So what you're saying is Michael Jordan's career holds up.
Well, it is interesting, you know, we did not all these guys we look at with contemporary lenses do hold up that well. But
I know, Mike, I got in all kinds of hot water. I got in all kinds of hot water with Iverson fans because I just, you know, he played a different game and, you know, he was a volume scorer. Doesn't mean he was not a brilliant player, but, you know, volume scoring is not appreciated in the NBA these days. So, you know, I'm sure that Allen Iverson, had he played in the modern NBA, would have altered his game and changed the way he played to be a great player. But if Allen Iverson played the way he did in 1999,
I think Kirk is trying to show you a picture of AI there.
Okay, sorry.
He was trying.
No, I'll show you. I remember when you had that Allen Iverson controversy, and we devote a whole chapter to Allen as well, because he did change the game forever. And if you ask modern players like Westbrook or Harden or Stephen or Donovan Mitchell what they think of this dude, they don't hem and haw about win shares and stuff. They say that guy shaped the game. And the way he made handling so cool and so important has really traveled into the future and influenced future generations. And when you watch Stephen break down a guy on the edge, or we watch Jason Tatum like we did tonight, break down guys, that's from the book of Iverson, guys. And that's the sort of point of this thing, is not all greatness is measured in rings and banners. Like, influencing your art form or your genre is like a really cool way to look at greatness. And that's what I tried to do. And Iverson is a very complicated guy for many reasons. But one thing that's definitely not controversial with him is, like, he influenced so many of the great players we're watching now.
For sure. And also, he was one of the great scorers of all time when he was one of the smallest guys in the league. So that will always be appreciated. Okay. So we have
smallest guy to win the last thing on that smallest guy to win the scoring title. And he won it 4 times. So there we go. Just wanted to get that in.
Yeah. So anyway, we got, thanks, Kirk. I'm definitely looking at cracking in that and looking at all that stuff, especially when the playoffs are over, when I can breathe, but you can do it now if you're a basketball fan. Hoop Atlas, check it out. So we got some series now, which is happy. I'm sure Bontemps is happy. He's coming back to Boston for game 5.
Hey, we like a competitive series. Brian's longstanding reverse jinx as we get into Cavs Corner, sponsored by nobody. Cavs Corner. Right. Everybody's happy in Cavs Corner. Big win for the Cavs today.
Yeah, they won by 24 points. It was a tie game at halftime, and they ended up blowing out the Celtics in the second half. But before I talk about that, Bontemps, this is arguably, and maybe not even arguably, the best performance of Evan Mobley's career, considering the stakes. Evan Mobley was the two-way player tonight that the Cavs envisioned and dreamed of and still dream of when they drafted him and watched him become. He didn't win Rookie of the Year. He was runner-up, but he was brilliant as a rookie. This is the player that they envisioned playing alongside Donovan Mitchell, dominant on defense, which he's been dominant on defense throughout the playoffs, but dominant on offense in this game right from the start.
Yeah, I mean, look, he ends the game with 21 points, which doesn't sound like a ton, but he had 15 in the first half, and especially right at the beginning of the game. It's obviously easy to forget now that Cleveland's won by 24 and cruised this win, but they were down 14-5 3 or 4 minutes into the game. And J.B. Bickerstaff calls a quick timeout. You're thinking, well, here we go again. Celtics cruise this game 1 win. They're going to cruise to win in game 2. And the Cavs come back and have a 25-7 run and take the lead. And a lot of that was Evan Mobley scoring inside. And it wasn't anything super complicated, but he was aggressive and making shots and making plays.
Made a three-pointer.
And helped them.
First time in weeks.
Made a three, and got him back in the game. And then once he got him back in the game, it was his defense that really set the tone in this game. I mean, some of the numbers on this stuff, I'm pulling them up from my game story that I filed. On shots within 10 feet of the basket that Evan Mobley guarded, the Celtics were 3 for 11. Overall, they were 8 for 21 on shots he guarded. And when he was guarding Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown, they were a combined 2 for 10. And all that tracks because he was really good and really big at the rim and out in space, but especially at the rim, like he was in game 7 against Orlando. Huge part of why the Cavs got out of that game, which they certainly tried at times to not get out of. But he was tremendous on defense in that game, and combination timely offense, particularly in the first half, and then just awesome defensive performance set the stage for Donovan Mitchell to take over in the third quarter. He did, and the Cavs completely smoke these guys in a game they came into as 12.5-point underdogs and win by 24, the biggest win by a double-digit underdog in a playoff game in at least 35 years. Hmm. So obviously a heck of a performance by Cleveland and makes this a series again. And we'll see what happens as this thing goes back to what's it called now? Rocket Mortgage Fieldhouse, I think. Back to Cleveland for game three.
The Rock.
Well, back to the super loud arena in Cleveland where a lot of people will be yelling at me about Evan Mobley, I'm sure, for game three.
Yeah, Kirk, the Cavs had been shooting the three-pointer terribly. I had kind of an interesting moment on TV today. While I was talking about the Cavs on NBA Today, I referred to their need to, quote, get off the schneid, which I have never said that on television before. I don't know why I said it. I just started saying it, and I was like, you have to commit to that. And, you know, after every show that we do on NBA Today, we get evaluated. We get critiqued, just like the players. Just like we critique the players, we get critiqued by our producers. And our producer, Pete McConville, he was like off the schneid. And it is a very old man phrase. It sounds like something I'm sure I got it from my father. I probably haven't said that phrase in a decade. I have no idea why I said it. But I'll be darned, Kirk, if the Cavs didn't get off the schneid, because the thing that happened in this game after Mobley kept them close in the first half was that after shooting 27% on threes over their first eight playoff games, they got real hot in the third quarter, especially Donovan Mitchell, and that's what blew the game open. So three-point shooting, who knew it could help you?
Yeah, three-point shooting. But you're exactly right. They are no longer on the schneid. I mean, game one, 120, Boston 120, Cleveland 95. And this was almost a scrimmage with Cleveland taking the big number and giving the Boston. So they fixed a lot of stuff on both ends of the court. But the three-point shooting was really what opened the game up. And Donovan Mitchell looking like the best player in the game, which is an interesting point for us, because I really think that's when this game changed and when the series might have changed, was when Donovan Mitchell really asserted himself in that third quarter, both as a jump shooter and as attacker. Caris LeVert played a marvelous game as well for Cleveland. That's the kind of role player that generally doesn't show up on
far
the road,
and away his best game in the playoffs. He was on the schneid. Yeah. He was on the big schneid as well.
Yeah. Well, he had a big stretch in the second quarter of game seven, helped turn that game around for Cleveland. And, you know, we're going to talk about PJ Washington in the other game later. And to your point, Kirk, in a road playoff game, especially, you have guys, these, you know, ancillary guys step up and make plays like this. That's usually what ends up being the difference. Evan Mobley's not a guy you expect to score 21 in a game. He had a huge game. Caris LeVert made some plays. You know, and it all set the stage for, like you said, Donovan Mitchell at halftime to take this game over. And look, the Celtics, this is what the Celtics have done over and over and over again. This is a team that likes to play with their food. They like to mess around. They were pretty lackadaisical throughout game one. They won the game comfortably. I think probably the single worst thing that happened to them was getting out to that 14-5 lead in the first 4 minutes of the game and thinking this was going to be easy. And the Cavs did not make it easy. They fought back in the game. They played really well. And sitting there at halftime, you're going, all right, game's tied. Let's see if the Celtics come out and really lay the hammer down the third quarter. And instead, Donovan Mitchell, who has now matched LeBron James as the only two guys in the history of the Cavs franchise to have at least 25 in five straight playoff games, pretty good company to be in. He has been awesome.
And you say 25?
At least 25 in five straight playoff games.
So I have Donovan Mitchell has averaged 35.8 points in his last five games. Second Cavs player to average 35 in five playoff games since Ricky Davis.
He probably ascended that one. But no, but listen, it was set up for Donovan to really be assertive and take over at the half, and he did. And the Celtics did not respond. And I think the Cavs deserve a ton of credit for fighting back in this series. And like we saw after game two against Miami, when a team came in here and hit a bunch of shots and again beat the Celtics. By the way, last three playoffs now, Celtics are 14-14 at home, which is just an amazing stat.
I have 1,000 levels. I'd like to update that stat. It's actually 15-15. Doesn't matter. They're 500 at home.
They're 500 at playoff. In the last 3 years, they got to the finals and the conference finals, and they're expected to go at least to the conference finals or beyond this year. And they're 500 at home, which is not how this is supposed to go. But this is what the Celtics have done, and we will see how they respond in Cleveland, where it's going to be a raucous environment, and the crowd's going to be ready to go, and the Cavs have some excitement. They could have Dean Wade back, which would be a really important piece for them. And let's see how this Celtics team responds from what Jason called an Jaylen Brown called an unacceptable defensive performance, and I would agree with that.
Yeah, Kirk, this was a classic thing that's happened to Boston ahead in the series, so they lose their focus a little bit, and they did drive the ball. They didn't just settle for threes like we've seen in some of their losses in recent years. In fact, they had more drives in this game, according to Second Spectrum, than any game in the Joe Mazzulla era. But they were driving into Evan Mobley, who was playing brilliant defense, and they also shot the three-pointer poorly. Most Celtics losses doesn't always mean that they're playing poorly or playing bad offense, but most of the time when the Celtics lose, it's because their three-point shot abandons them. They go 8 of 35 in this game. 35 is not an egregious number. Plenty of times the Celtics have lost where they've taken over 50 threes, but it is a feature. And so you have one team hitting their threes and the Celtics missing, and kind of what we often see from the Celtics losses in the playoffs, also at home.
Yeah. I mean, my old boss, the grumpy in grumpy mode, Greg Popovich, when he was asked about the modern NBA a few years ago, you guys probably remember this. He's like, I hate the threes. You just look at the box score and all you got to do is just look at who shot more threes, who made more threes. And you can tell who won. That's not always true, Coach Popovich. But in this case, that's sort of the signature element of this game. And Mazzulla ball is built around the three-point line. You guys know that. I think they made 10 or fewer threes in four of their 82 regular season games. They won one of those four. And tonight they made 8. So they didn't have it going from out there. And I did think Jason Tatum actually looked aggressive. Like you're saying, Brian, stats backed it up to the rim a few times. He was taking it to the hole. And just like sort of the Denver-Minnesota game 2 result the other night, I thought one of the things that people slept on there is Denver scored 80 freaking points, which was eye-popping. Not enough. But they did that with Rudy Gobert at home and not playing. And Jared Allen didn't play in this game. And Evan Mobley deserves all the credit in the world. But this is Jared Allen is the most important interior defender that the Cavaliers have. And so it'll be interesting if they can get back into this series and win one or two of these games at home with or without Jared. But if they have Jared Allen, how will they use him? Did they learn something tonight, Timmy? Did they learn something tonight, Brian? I don't know. But that shooting number really pops off the page. They made 8 of 35 threes, 23%. That's not going to get it done. And they lost the battle on the paint, 60 to 44. So that's where Evan Mobley's numbers really showed up, the ones that Tim was talking about earlier. But again, they did it without Jared Allen out there. And if they're going to have trouble scoring without Jared Allen, what's going to happen if Jared Allen's able to get back into the series healthy?
Yeah, look, the Cavs barely got through that Magic series, really had very little spurts where they played what they would consider good basketball. They did enough to win. This was far and away their most complete performance of the playoffs. This was closer to the team that they had throughout the middle of the season. And even though they still have some issues, Darius Garland's still not producing like they would prefer him to, you know, George Niang still not able to, you know, be the type of player they want. But this was, you know, when the Cavs envisioned how this could go and they were, you know, headed to be the number 2 seed and they were dreaming of facing the Celtics in the conference finals, this is the type of play that they were expecting. And they have beaten the Celtics 4 times now in the last 2 years. And, you know, they've played in Boston 4 times this season and they are 1-3, but they lost 2 close and now they've won 1. So, you know, I still think the Celtics are the heavy favorites, but the Cavs have some reason to believe in themselves. And Donovan is among the best players in the playoffs. He is absolutely delivering on what the Cavs, you know, had hoped for him when they gave up all those assets for him. And when you have a player playing at that level, you've got a fighting chance, especially if your role players show up, which they did in this game.
Well, and he also gets credit, I think, too, for the way he's leading the group. You know, he talked to Cassidy Hubbard after the game. The first thing he said was how great Evan Mobley played. First thing he said when he got to the podium was how great Evan Mobley played. And like for a guy who's trying to lead a team through to places it hasn't been, especially a guy like Evan Mobley who hasn't had a lot of playoff games, this is easily, like you said, the biggest game he's played in his career. Like, thought it was a pretty noteworthy thing that this guy stepped up and said, hey, look, like this guy was a huge part of why we won. Max Strus did the same thing. Like, it was an impressive performance all around from the Cavs. And, you know, look, the Celtics have been pretty abject through the first 2 games of this series, and let's see what they look like when they go on the road. Like, can they snap out of it and get back to playing the way they need to, which is what they did after game two against Miami. And they really dominated the final three games of that series. Or like Kirk said, have the Cavs figure some things out. And can Evan Mobley continue to play like this? I think Donovan's shown he's going to keep playing like this, but can they get some of these other guys to hit shots? Can they get Dean Wade back, get them some minutes to hit some shots? And can they make this thing a really interesting series? We'll find out on Saturday.
We sure will.
Tim, would you say that the Celtics are on the schneid now, Tim? Does it feel like they're on the schneid?
Jason Tatum is on the schneid, I would say. He has not shot the ball well at all throughout the playoffs. Had sort of a funny answer today. He got asked about, I don't remember exactly the question about the loss, but he went into this whole jag about how, you know, people act like we're a super team, but we didn't get MVP. We didn't get coach of the year. We didn't get this other stuff. We didn't get rewarded.
Oh,
like a super team.
Us. Okay.
Yeah. It was an interesting.
I think it sounds like Jason was not happy. He was not in the top five for MVP.
I'm sure Jason Tatum was very unhappy. He was not in the top five for MVP. But I mean, he had sort of some meandering answers like that. And Jaylen Brown walked in and said it was an unacceptable defensive performance. That kind of showed that's sort of the different personalities between two of those guys.
Exactly right. JB is
Tatum was not bothered, and Jaylen was bothered.
Yeah, JB is often much more blunt. All right, we had another.
I should clarify. When I say not bothered, he's still very confident in his team. I shouldn't say he was like, I shouldn't make it seem like he didn't care that they lost, but they come across very differently in their interviews.
Yeah, he's more blunt. Cuts the heart.
Jaylen is much more like Marcus Smart used to be here.
More Hoop Collective podcast after this.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, like UNTUCKit or Allbirds, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business making, selling, and for shoppers, buying simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret was Shop Pay that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whatever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more, sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout UNTUCKit uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/hoop, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/hoop to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/hoop. All right, so in the game in Oklahoma City, McMahon is toiling away right now, probably waiting for Luka Doncic to speak. To me, everything, Kirk, was about what Luka would look like in this game. It was very concerning the way he played on, what was it, Tuesday night? It just looked like he had no lift. His step back was compromised. I thought he looked much more comfortable in this game. The results bore it out. He had 29 points. Even after he rolled his ankle, and I think it was either late third or early fourth quarter, he shook that off. That looked shaky. He shook that off and still looked much, much stronger. Now, the Mavericks got some great three-point shooting, especially from P.J. Washington, who he was 7 of 11. I mean, you get a role player like that on the road, hit 7 of 11.
Well, not even just him. P.J. Washington, Tim Hardaway, Josh Green combined to go 12 for 20. From three.
Yeah,
Tim Hardaway. Three guys go 12 for 20 from three, you're going to be in really good shape. Again, to go back to Kirk's point about Caris LeVert, road playoff games, they had Luka step up, like Donovan stepped up for the Cavs, and then some of the others came to play. That made the difference.
Yeah, there was a stretch in the third quarter where Tim Hardaway, who's just back from ankle injury, got red hot and scored like maybe 10 or 12 points in a row. And that was the point of the game where the Mavericks basically got control and they never looked back. Kirk, what was your impression of the Mavericks bounce back victory, especially what Luka looked like in game two?
Yeah, when Luka's threes go in, that's the best deodorant for this team, period. And he hadn't made a lot of threes, as you pointed out, Brian, in this game they were falling, and it goes. But I'll give you something else. You did a good job covering that. Is if you would have told me they were going to steal one of these two games, in Oklahoma City, I wouldn't have been shocked. I would have been impressed, but I would have been shocked. And I tell you what, I would have predicted something else would have happened. I would have predicted Kyrie Irving would have been a big part of that. And that's not what happened tonight. Kyrie Irving had a miserable game by his standards. He was 2 of 8. He had 9 points, and he was a non-factor on the three-point line. But as Tim and you have pointed out, this is about a couple other role players and PJ Washington, who to me epitomizes how this team got sort of a personality and a personnel transplant in February and became something other than what they were before February. And PJ Washington had 29 points, only behind SGA for the game, and tied with his teammate Luka Doncic. So all credit to the role players. If you would have told me they were going to win with Kyrie Irving scoring 9 points in that gym, which is one of the hardest places to win in the playoffs, both you guys know that, I also would have told Kyrie, you were crazy.
Kyrie has PTSD in Oklahoma City from the bed bugs.
At the Skirvin?
At the Skirvin, yes. Yeah. Which,
yes.
My favorite part of that entire story, well, probably maybe not my favorite part, but was Dave McMenamin was with the Cavs, covering the Cavs, and when Kyrie basically like took himself out of the game in the first half and like never came back. And when after the game was asked about it, he explained that he was skeeved out because he had bed bugs. Dave just called the hotel and whoever answered, hello, Skirvin Hotel. Yes, I'm from ESPN. Yes. Kyrie Irving said he had bed bugs last night. Yes, that's true. Oh, thank you. The hotel is just like, yeah, that's true. I was like, thank you for confirming that. Okay, Bontemps, we need to have a discussion about Josh Giddey again.
We do.
Now we've talked about this on and off throughout the year. In the last series against New Orleans, Josh Giddey was excellent. Played some of his best basketball of his career in that short stretch. He was a big factor.
Also, let's be honest, was kind of irrelevant.
I'm not going to be honest on that. No, he had some good games in that series. You got to give him his credit.
He had some good games, but they were playing a dramatically overmatched team that they blasted out of the playoffs.
Yeah, but one of the reasons they blasted him was because he was really good. Don't go down that line.
He played well. Played well.
I say he did pretty well for that being his first playoff series. Okay. So in game one, in the second half, the game was close. And maybe even they'd given up the lead. And Mark Daigneault took Josh Giddey off the floor. He brought in Isaiah Joe in that particular case. Isaiah Joe immediately stretched the floor, started hitting threes, loosened everything up. Thunder took off, won game one easily. I know Luka was lumbering, but that was a big thing. Josh Giddey had a disastrous game two. He played 11 minutes and was minus 20. And obviously there was some other stuff going in, like the Mavericks made, of the three-pointers that they made, they really made some contested threes. It isn't all on Josh Giddey, just to be clear. But he's minus 27 in the two games so far in this series. I'm not saying that you would maybe change your starting lineup in game two or in game three of a 1-1 series, but this is not looking like it's a Giddey series right now, Bontemps.
Well, look, they're playing a real team. It's going very poorly.
Don't rip the Pelicans. The Pelicans were injured and the Dorcher chamber was wrapped around Ingram.
Yeah, the Pelicans were an overmatched team. It's not a crime to say that. There was a 1-8 series that they won in a sweep. Okay. They didn't have Zion. This isn't saying the Pelicans are a disaster. But like the Thunder cruised in that series. So with the Josh Giddey minutes didn't really matter either way, is my point. And what did we see at halftime of this game? We saw Mark Daigneault take him out of the lineup and play somebody else, right? And you could say, well, I don't know if you change your lineup in a 1-1 series, but they're also going on the road. They lost home court advantage in the series. And this is the thing that we have talked about repeatedly throughout the season, that when they get in a real playoff series, what are they going to do? And it's minus 27 in two games. And as you point out, he was minus 20 in 11 minutes in a game they lost by 9.
That's rough. It's a rough situation. I'm not going to lie. If I was trying to defend him, it would not go well.
Well, but it's not even about defending Josh Giddey. Josh Giddey is a good player who's good at a lot of things. What he's not good at is shooting, and he's not necessarily a very effective partner with Shai Gilgeous-Alexander in Oklahoma City's backcourt. It's just the facts of it. Shai is one of the three or four best players in the league, probably. He's going to have the ball all the time, and Josh Giddey is not. And I understand why the Thunder haven't gone away from this to this point, but it's time to really have the discussion. Because Mark Daigneault did it in the second half of this game. And maybe he'll roll back out there with them in game three in the starting lineup. Or maybe he won't. But for a team that we have talked about and praised, frankly, for being willing to try a lot of different things and do a lot of different things. I think for a whole lot of reasons, many of which have to do with eventually moving on from Josh Giddey at some point for more stuff, would be my guess. They have not done this move and taken him out of the starting lineup on a full-time basis when he probably is most effective as a sixth man, coming in with Shea is not on the court and running the offense for them. So now we will see how they react. But we saw how they reacted at halftime. And it's hard for me to argue against taking him out of the starting lineup. Like, what's the argument for keeping him in it other than, I guess you could argue you don't want to panic, but I don't think it's a panic move to change things.
Well, here's what I'm going to say. He's played like 217 games in his career, and I believe he started every single one of them.
Well, I mean, he started every single one of them for a lot of reasons.
Okay, fine. But I'm just saying, like, you know, like, I'm not arguing. I'm not saying that.
Right. But if the best argument for starting Josh Giddey is he hasn't come off the bench before, that's, again, not a very compelling argument.
Fair enough. But it's, you know, it's a pretty radical change to do in game three of a 1-1.
Well, again, I just talked about how their coach, Mark Daigneault, who I voted for coach of the year, has done a phenomenal job, is constantly tinkering with stuff. And it's been very apparent all year. There's a reason we've talked about it all year. This has been the existential question with this team, really, the whole season. And now we're at the moment when the rubber's going to hit the road, you would have to think. And are they just going to stick with this? Maybe they will. But we saw at halftime, went away from it. So it's certainly something I think that has to be on the table if you're doing that.
Well, Kirk, you've sat in meetings with coaches in the front office and had conversations like this. I suspect this will be happening.
Yeah, and they're definitely different in the postseason. Yeah, I think so. And if you look,
what
at
are those conversations
numbers, guys,
like, Kirk? It's been a little bit of a different situation because, like, you're obviously we're dealing with veteran players, and sometimes it'd be like, when are we going to put Manu in the starting lineup or whatever? But like for people who have been in those meetings, like what are those like after a game like this?
Yeah, the coaches and some of the front office will sit in a post game room, and different organizations have different strategies there. But we would look at some numbers, and one number that you guys haven't brought up is that the Mavericks, I think, were 7 of 7 when they attacked Josh Giddey in the first half. So it wasn't just something they were seeing on the offense, and that's the first thing that I think when they're looking for a lineup change, Tim, in a game where Dallas scored 119 points, which is about like 23 more than they scored in game one. So they're looking at defense, and Giddey wasn't effective on that end of the court at all. And I'm with you. I think the second half thing was probably a cue that they're going to try a different starting lineup. If I had to guess right now, I'm the third quarter and that's a different starting lineup, that's probably what we're going to see in game two, particularly because this team is so deep and there are other options there. Isaiah Joe being one of them who brings you instant off the ball spacing and shooting. So I think you go over these games player by player with a fine tooth comb in the playoffs as a staff a lot more closely than you do in the regular season. And frankly, you make lineup changes, and some of those changes can switch a series around. So we'll see what happens. But if I had to guess, guys, I'm on Tim's side here. I think we're going to see a different starting lineup in game three in Dallas, Texas.
Chet Holmgren had a rough game, 4-12, 1 of 6 from 3-point range. He did defend the rim a little bit. Lu Dort wasn't as effective defensively on Luka, which, you know, that happens. You know, you're not going to be a defensive ace every game. But the Giddey thing is an interesting, you know, inflection point in the series. But the reawakening of Luka is what I'm going to say here. Another thing is we could be watching for another 5 games, a pretty good battle between Luka and Shea. Shea had a terrific
game. Shea was pretty good. He only had 33, 12, and 8.
Yeah, and I was interested. I was kind of surprised. The reaction to the MVP vote was surprising to me, Bontemps. And I guess it's because I just know the poll is so effectively and so right most of the time.
It was down to about the percentage point correct this time, I will nice. Say.
Yeah, I mean, and so like when the final poll comes out, I mean, obviously if it's skin tight and then one guy goes on a run, like there would be mystery. But there wasn't, you know, the Doncic fans were frustrated because the Mavericks 16-2 finish. They thought they would push Luka to get some more, and he just, you know, he finished third like the poll projected. There were some people who came out and were like how could Shea not be closer? And I was like, Shea had a brilliant season, but Jokic was amazing. Like I don't know. Maybe it's just because people have to have a reaction to it. They can't
I think it's say. That. I always get confused at the reaction to this stuff. Like there's three or four guys every year that deserve to win MVP. Jalen Brunson deserved to win MVP. If you're just saying like who deserved it, like lots of guys deserve it, but only one person can win it. That's all. Yeah. It's not a crime to finish second to Nikola Jokic. It's not a crime to finish third to Nikola Jokic, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. It's not a crime to finish fourth if you're Giannis behind those two guys and Luka Doncic. Like, it's okay. It's all okay in the end. Yeah. And look, part of it's obviously because of what's happened over the last week and the fact that Denver got waxed a couple times and it's down 0-2. Like, that's all how this stuff ultimately goes. But look, at the end of the day, if you're the Thunder, since I just bagged on about the Josh Giddey thing, they get outscored by 24 at the three-point line. The three guys I mentioned before, PJ Washington, Josh Green, Tim Hardaway, outshoot the Thunder from three by themselves in this game. Probably not going to be a regular occurrence in the series. Maybe it will. If it is, the Thunder are going to be out of the playoffs pretty quick. And, you know, it's not like the sky is falling here. Like they lost by 9 and didn't play their best game. And they have a lot of different options still at their disposal. So this series, we all thought was going to be long. Certainly looks like it's going to be long. And I'm kind of glad Dallas won this game, frankly, because it augurs for what should be a pretty awesome 6 or 7 game series ahead.
More Hoop Collective podcast after this.
All right. Can anybody guess on this here podcast who today's reliable connection brought to you by Xfinity is?
Well, I'm going to guess the first time it was the Xfinity hometown Villanova Wildcats. The yes. second time it was the Xfinity hometown Villanova Wildcats.
That's right.
And I'm going to guess this time it's going to be the Xfinity hometown Villanova Wildcats.
Gold star, Bontemps.
There you Brilliant go. Work. Look at that.
Brilliant work. I mean, nobody is more reliable, brought to you by Xfinity, than the Villanova trio. I will say, you've seen probably a couple hundred games in Madison Square Garden, Bontemps. I've seen, you know, dozens. I will remember game 2 for a while. Because
I'll remember it because I wasn't there and I was sitting in Boston going, it would have been fun to be at this game. Yeah, would have been good.
You were preparing to cover the Clack Cavaliers.
I was
Donovan
preparing.
Mitchell versus Jason Tatum. So Kirk, I have to tell you, so, you know, New York right now, the Knicks fans, you know, who are long suffering, they're in euphoria, but they're being put through some drama. They're being put through some drama by the Rangers too. And so like they're loving it, but they're pulling out their hair and they're arriving the next day with, you know, bloodshot eyes because the dramatic way the Knicks are playing is just crazy. And so Jalen Brunson leaves the court and there's no explanation or reason why. And then the Knicks say it's a sore right foot. And I actually missed the second quarter of this game, basically, which the Pacers played great basketball. And I still don't have a good feel what happened in the second quarter because I was sitting in the press box rewatching every step that Brunson took in the first quarter, trying to identify where he might have hurt his foot. And I'm going to tell you, I really couldn't find it, which is concerning because it makes you wonder if that foot was already bothering him. I don't know that to be true, just to be so. But the feeling in the building when Brunson was gone. And then as soon as the announcement was made, obviously the media blasted it out and everybody there has phones. It was like, oh my God. Like it was like, just, it was almost like a turned into like a funeral. Like, and everybody, you know, you could just tell they were like, oh, well, that's it. You know, what a great run, you know, the sort of the New York way of just, you know, sort of jumping to conclusions. But so the halftime happens, you know, half the bowl empties out. And then unbeknownst to anybody, it just wasn't known. Jalen Brunson comes walking out. Now, I am obliged, I am obligatory to say that it was the 54th anniversary of the Willis Reed night, which just tells you how the schedule's changed. That was game 7 of the finals on May 8th, 1980.
Yes, yes.
And before the game, well, first off, they got a whole bunch of Knicks, just historic Knicks. I mean, they got everybody from Bill Bradley and Walt Frazier to Latrell Sprewell and
Carmelo,
John Starks. Okay. Steve Novak is there. Nick Great, once a Nick, always a Nick. Steve Novak with the discount double check 3-pointer. You remember that?
The dentist.
Because he was from Wisconsin.
And Novocaine.
Exactly. Good one. Yep. So anyway, they went through at the beginning of the game, they hyped the crowd up by, of course, replaying the Willis Reed, you know, moment where he's coming out of the tunnel limping. He makes two baskets. And then Willis Reed is no longer with us. So they put a spotlight on his retired jersey up in the rafters. And then they have Walt Frazier and they go, and of course, Walt Frazier, Clyde had 34 points and 19 assists. You know, that's what the thing about.
It was maybe the greatest game seven performance ever and nobody remembers it.
Right. But they have him center court, you know, and he's wearing, you know, a resplendent nectarine suit. So already the crowd is like, you know, that was pregame. So out comes Jalen Brunson and all of a sudden, like the crowd reacted in like a second. And there was like, oh, you know, everybody. And people start pouring in from the concourses. They're like running in to see, like, is Brunson going to play? And Jalen was visibly uneasy and nervous. And he hears the murmuring and people are going crazy. And he gives the calm down signal to the crowd. And I just want to reiterate, this is during halftime. With like 7 minutes on the clock, there's no halftime show. I mean, it was over. And he's basically saying, everybody calm down. And like everyone's watching every step that he does, every dribble. And so this was such a remarkable moment. And again, the Knicks are down 10 at this point. And this, the third quarter starts. And they were, you could tell they were being very careful with him. Probably I don't have this exactly charted, but I'll bet in the first six possessions of the second half, they went with Josh Hart as the initiator, like maybe three of them. They were clearly trying to take him off the ball to let him test it out. And it was, there's still the nerves were going, but instantaneously, then you could tell the Knicks like got wind back in their sails and all of a sudden started playing much better, totally pivoted the game. Jalen started making some plays, started feeling better. All of a sudden, like looked a little bit more nimble on that foot. He wasn't changing.
Only went on a 19-4 run in five minutes. Right. We completely re-raised the 10-point deficit.
Oh, they got rid of it in seconds. And then they started running up and down the court. They were flying. Josh Hart was flying up and down. Isaiah Hartenstein, who is just having a master. Talk about a guy who's making money in this postseason. This guy's going to get paid major dollars, but that's another story. And it was just, you know, the Garden is going through it. You know, they're going through this emotion. And the Pacers are going through the emotion, too, because the Pacers didn't handle it very well. You know, Tyrese Halliburton was really under some heat after only scoring 6 points in game one. And he vowed he would be better. And he comes out and scores 22 points in the first half. And you're like, wow, Tyrese backed it up. You know, this is exactly what you want to see from a young star. And then like during this run, he was nowhere to be found. He was not able to stem the tide. Pascal Siakam, who was really good in games one and two in Milwaukee to start the postseason, has not been very good. And he was nowhere to be found. And they just kind of blended into the wall as the Knicks went on this blast. And like, up here they go. And there goes Jalen. I will say this, in my view, he wasn't quite as good moving side to side. He still had those awesome Brunson dribbles.
He looked pretty good in the fourth quarter.
Yeah, but he was a little careful with his change of directions. And so the run is on. I can't remember who goes to the basket. Hartenstein slaps it away at the basket. Crowd erupts. They're in the middle of the run. Ball bounces out to Brunson. And I don't think with the angle that they showed on TV, you know, showed how awesome of a pass Jalen Brunson threw to OG Anunoby, who, by the way, was playing probably his best game as a Knick. The only reason it was only a 10-point game at half was because OG
dominated. Yep.
He had 22 points with, you know, Brunson sat the last sat. He was in the locker room doing who knows what. And that's another untold thing. And OG Anunoby is streaking down the court. Brunson hits him with an awesome diagonal cross court, long, like 40-foot pass. He's at full speed. He is about to throw down a hellacious dunk. And Rick Carlisle was going to have to call timeout because the Garden was going to go nuts. And bam, he can't get off the ground.
Blew a tire.
Immediately grabs his left hamstring. And here we go. And Kirk, you know, the Spurs and you study, you know, the Spurs went the cutting edge of monitoring player workloads. Look, I'm not a doctor. I don't know exactly why that happened, but it was at full speed when he was making an athletic play. And the first thing I did was go and say, how many minutes has OG been playing? And it was 46 minutes on average over the previous four games, 46. And he played over, he had played like 23 or he was on his way to like 42, I think was on the pace. And I immediately asked stats and information. I go, has OG ever played 46 minutes over four games? And they came back, nope. So Kirk, I mean, I'll never prove it, but
yeah,
that was a casualty of the way the Knicks are playing. And they obviously won the game. And we'll talk about the Pacers and the referees in a second. But he is going to be out on Friday. I would be stunned if he plays on Sunday. Jalen is listed as questionable with the right foot soreness. And they're, of course, not saying why the foot is sore. But for a team being up 2-0, this is as tenuous as you can be because of what the Knicks are looking at injury-wise.
Yeah, they're dropping like flies. Go back to that Mitchell Robinson injury, and this team is not where they were just a few weeks ago, a few days ago. And OG, for those of us who've been following this incredible Knicks season, you know, his plus minus numbers all season long, and Tim knows this, have been just off the charts. When they got him into their rotation and he was able to play, they were great. He was not able to play, they were not so great. In this matchup against the Pacers, he's vital. Not only is their rotation so thin now because of the aforementioned injuries, but he is guarding Pascal Siakam, his old friend from Toronto, and he's their best matchup against their second best player in Indiana and a guy who can win games. So now it looks like it's going to have to be Precious Achiuwa, another former teammate from Toronto, who's going to get that assignment. But you're exactly right. I was thinking, and I had my notes, like a 2-0 lead has never felt this sort of sketchy, because you got to believe Indiana's going to win game three. And probably game four if these players aren't going to be able to play. And then now we're talking 2-2. And who knows what that means for the rest of the series. Everybody's going to go where you want with the Tibbs stuff. He plays his guys too much. They always get hurt. I'm not going to go there. The stats speak for themselves. I mean, the joke that I think Josh Hart made the other day about somebody else not this affects you. He's like, it doesn't affect me. I'm going to play 48 minutes no matter what. You're not going to hear other teams say that, right, Tim? You're not going to hear many other coaches and teams have a player just joking about how they're going to play 48 minutes in the NBA playoffs. So it is what it is. And the Knicks have the shortest bench left in the playoffs for whatever reason. And they're going to need somebody to step up if they want to keep this sort of vibe alive, that bing bong vibe. Into the Indiana part of the series.
Yeah, I mean, look, they've had some bad luck, right? Bojan Bogdanovic had his leg fallen on by Nicholas Batum in Philly in the last round. Julius Randle got hurt. Jaime Jaquez took a charge on him earlier this year. So Mitchell Robinson's been dealing with this ankle thing off and on for months. You know, he obviously came back from that.
Some of the Knicks fans who I know are screaming at me, why are you not talking about how Joel Embiid knocked out Mitchell Robinson? Like they are frustrated that Embiid is not getting flack for that, because the Knicks believe that Robinson's re-injury happened when Joel made the takedown. So
he grabbed the opposite leg when that happened. But I don't think we need to relitigate that.
That's fine.
It whatever happened there, it's obviously an unfortunate thing for Mitchell Robinson and the Knicks. But look, I got some flack earlier this year when I said Jalen Brunson was the most popular person in New York sports at the moment. There were people like, what about Aaron Judge? What are you talking about? Well, all you got to do is look at what's going on in New York right now, where it is a religious experience at Madison Square Garden every time the Knicks play. And Jalen Brunson is, you can't have a higher Q rating than Jalen Brunson has. It's like basically at Taylor Swift levels at this point. And when he is doing his thing at the Garden, there's nothing like it in sports. There's just nothing like it, because the Knicks fans are so starved for success. This is a team that this year has won a playoff series for a second year in a row. It had not done that since the year 2000. They had only won a couple playoff series in this century. They haven't made the conference finals since 2000. Like, this is the team that has had very little success over the past 25 years since they made the finals back in 99 and the conference finals the year after. After being dominant, one of the dominant forces in the East outside the Bulls for the 90s. And that New York is a city where you mentioned how people jump to conclusions in New York. Well, people in New York, for all the glitz and glamour there, they love scrappy underdog stories. And Jalen Brunson is the ultimate scrappy underdog story. It's why people there have connected with him the way he has. This whole thing has come out of nowhere for people there in a lot of ways. And it's why these games at the Garden have been a complete madhouse for the past couple of weeks. And I understand why you say that the Knicks are probably going to lose these two games, Kirk, but I think they're going to win at least one of them because I don't trust Indiana. And I think, assuming Jalen Brunson's playing, the Pacers cannot guard him. They couldn't guard him again in the second half of game two. Rick Carlisle, I don't really understand what he's doing. Just having Andrew Nembhard guard him one-on-one. He's getting destroyed every time down the court. And it's not really Nembhard's fault. They're not giving him any other looks.
Against Nembhard, Jalen Brunson is 14 of 21 for 33 points.
And all of those shots are practice shots. Like, there's not any – he's getting everywhere he wants to go. He's entirely comfortable every time he shoots the ball. Like, they have to do something different, whether it's trying to teach him McConnell more, who's had some success, whether it's trying Aaron Nesmith on him, who's at least bigger, though he's going to foul him a lot. They got to do something different because that ain't working. And, you know, the Knicks just keep on coming. And whether it's Precious
Achiuwa
or Deuce
McBride. But, Tim, this is
Deuce
the worst defense in the playoffs. It's one of the worst defenses in the NBA all year. This is what they
– That is correct. That is correct. That's why I don't trust them to stop the Knicks enough to win both these games at home.
I want you to close your eyes and picture a confused Tom Thibodeau. It shouldn't be hard. And that's what his face looked like when he looked up at the end of the game and saw the Knicks had 130 points. You know, that's not Knicks basketball.
Well, and again, the fact that they're giving up 130 points to this Knicks team says all you need to know about the Pacers, who, by the way, scuffled and dragged their feet kicking and screaming through that first round series against Milwaukee, where despite all the injuries Milwaukee had, they kept trying to lose it every way possible. So I don't have a lot of faith in this team right now to get two wins in a row against a Knicks team that, even with these injuries, the one thing about the Knicks is they're going to make you earn the wins. They play hard all the way to the buzzer. They're going to be crashing the glass. We're going to be flying around on defense. If Jalen's out there, he's probably going to score 30 plus again. And the Pacers are going to have to take it from them. And they have not really shown the ability to do that. And I'm very curious to see what these games over the weekend look like and if they can show a little more mettle than they have so far in these playoffs.
All right. So let's talk about the officiating with the Pacers. Now, Rick Carlisle obviously came out. I assume that he'll be fine before game three. What are we thinking? 75?
No.
50?
25. I think 25.
Okay.
He didn't curse at anybody.
No, but he, like, you know, the whole small market, big market thing.
My guess is 20.
Kirk, fine guess?
I'm going to go with, I'll take the under 75. I did some math on your complaint thing, though. The clips they sent in, Brian. 78, was it? That's one for every 75 seconds of gameplay.
Yeah, it's completely asinine. So by the way, I was going to say, Kirk, as somebody who, again, has been in rooms with teams for playoff games, can you, because we've alluded to this some on the pod at different points, can you explain to people what the process is of sending these clips into the league? Obviously, we know, like, as we have told people, every team does this. It's not like it's an individual thing, but can you, like, give people sort of an explainer on how this works?
Yeah, well, coaches get mad about calls. I know you guys know that part. And then after the game, they'll ask the video group to pull a few clips, and then they'll decide with the general manager, usually, if we should send these clips to New York or not, complain about them. And a lot of times they pull them and then don't send them. So when Brian reported they pulled 78 from two games, my eyes were just popping out of my head because I couldn't imagine how many. That's literally almost every call, isn't it, Brian? Did you do any analysis on this?
Well, it was 20. Rick on the record said that it was 20.
There were 29
from game one. And they did exactly what you said. They pulled them and then they decided to take the high road and they didn't send them. And then I was told separately that they pulled 49. And by the way, they weren't. It's not 49 calls where they felt that there was a foul and it shouldn't have been. 49 times where there was either a foul or there wasn't a foul. You know,
there was something. There wasn't a foul.
But I will say this. Yes. I will say in 49, and obviously there's 48 minutes in the game, so more than one a minute. I will say this.
Just ridiculous.
His complaints were not about game two. His complaints were about game one and about game three. Because they took I was actually surprised that they didn't freak out about game one, because I do think that the calls in game one were extremely costly and blatant errors.
Well, this is where the ridiculous thing, but this is where the ridiculous thing is about what he did, right? We were sitting there, we were both in the interview room for game one, waiting to see what Rick was going to do. And he walks in, and I think pretty smartly, with a young, inexperienced team in a spot they haven't been in before, says, hey, look, obviously would like to add some of these calls, but we're going to focus on doing our stuff better. We made some mistakes. That's not why we lost the game. It's going to be all right. I thought it was a pretty smart way to handle it. I thought his team responded to it really well. They play really well in game two. They're right there. They don't win the game. There weren't really any egregious calls in game two at all, really. It was pretty normal game officiating wise. And then he comes in after the game and completely loses his mind and gets ejected when there wasn't really anything to complain about, when the prior game he had all sorts of stuff to actually complain about and be mad about. I don't know. I don't really understand what the thought process is, particularly when you talk to his players and the players were all like, yeah, we lost the game.
The thought process was he was beginning to cede the ground for game three, which is as old as time in the playoffs.
I suppose. Yeah. I just would have ceded the ground for game two. I don't know if I was going to do that. Like, it's probably when I would have done it. Would have been for game two rather than wait a game and do it for game three. I guess is more my point. If you're going to do that at all. But I also don't think that does anything for game three, personally. I know people do it, but I don't think it really impacts anything.
It probably won't, but what if it does? Like that's the thing.
Well, I know. This is why people, yeah. I understand this is why people do it.
I also will say this.
Timing is weird.
I couldn't afford to miss Rick Carlisle, so I didn't actually make it to the Pacers locker room. So I was sort of at the mercy of what, you know, and they brought up TJ McConnell and Tyrese Haliburton, and both of them didn't exactly ratify Rick Carlisle's position. I think they were both like, look, yeah, there were some calls we didn't like, but you know, they got 57% shooting. They gave up 67% shooting in the third quarter.
Right.
They gave up 65% shooting in the second half of game one. So they got to clean that up. You know, you may get 1.5 extra calls in your own building, but you know, if you don't clean that up,
they have to guard their yard better if they want any chance of winning this series. So that's it.
I like that. That was really good. Guard your yard better, Tim Bontemps. All right, Kirk. Well, thank you for taking some time, and I know you've been on the book tour, so
Are we not going to talk about the other series at all before we go?
No, we're not, because it's been 3 days, and I don't feel like talking.
Wow! Look at that.
Well, we'll have played two more games by Sunday, and we can do it. And it's frankly 1:30 in the morning, and I want to go to bed. If you want the honest answer,
there it is. We got the sleep update in, folks. We got it in.
Yeah,
we got it in.
His REM is on the schneid, folks.
Oh my
his
God.
REM is on the schneid.
Four straight nights of 3 hours. That's the truth. You know, what do you want me to say? All right. Thank you, Kirk. Thank you to Jackson, our producer. Thank you to Bontemps for staying late at TD Garden. And thank you for watching and listening to the Hoop Collective, which is presented by Xfinity. We will talk to you next week.